Good evening, everyone. I'm Alison Donnelly, a Payments Regulation Specialist and Director of FSCOM. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. We're very pleased to have some industry guests with us this year. And so I'd love it if Fergal could introduce himself first, please.
Hi, Fergal Brady. I'm the co-founder and CEO of No Friction. We're a fintech scale-up, I suppose. We're an Irish company, tech company. We are an electronic money institution. We were authorized by the Central Bank of Ireland last July. And we specialize in the area of embedded finance, and in particular within that. Our idea, I suppose, is to enable companies to become their own bank, in the sense that we provide them with almost direct access to the payments rails, enable them to send and receive funds, process those funds, and enable them to access programmable current accounts, so programmable money. So we address the problem of pre-processing and post-processing of payments. So we're not a payments company, although we do payments. Our real focus is on what happens before a payment happens, what happens after a payment happens, which is typically a manual process or involves some kind of manual process. So our goal is to automate all that. So we're focused on the business market, the European market, and we're about 2.5 years old. So that's it. We're also registered as a BASP. My co-founder, Aaron, is one of the core contributors to Bitcoin. We're really interested in it as a technology and the power and potential of it in the future. So our core banking platform that we've built ourselves is one of the first with. That's it.
Thank you, Fergal. Jer.
Yeah. Hi, good afternoon, all. My name is Jer Guest. I'm a relationship director on the fintech industry working with Barclays Bank Ireland. I guess the comparison between myself and Fergal is quite pronounced in that, you know, we're the traditional bank with, what, 425 years of in existence, but more focused upon the more common or garden requirements of the sector in relation to both safeguarding and the ultimate payments thereafter. I guess from a Barclays perspective, you know, we're here in Ireland north of 45 years. And since Brexit, we've been stood up as the head office for Barclays in Europe, although that is being looked at from a licensing perspective, and there's talks about migration to France under ACPR. We are dedicated to and have dedicated to the fintech sector, and by fintech we mean predominantly those entities for whom license is a requirement and payments is a feature, and do so very much in line with sort of the accepted standards and regulations that exist throughout the jurisdiction in which we operate.
Thank you, Jar. Russell.
Hi, Russell Burke. I'm a regulatory payments consultant for the last 2.5 years, working for myself, and also very delighted to be an associate consultant with FSCOM. I've just realized, Jar, for 10% of that 450 years of Barclays, I've been working in financial services. And the entire time Barclays has been here in Ireland. I was previously with the, up to 2.5 years ago, I was with the payments authorizations team in the Central Bank of Ireland, where I worked for 7 years. And before that, I was 36 years with Bank of Ireland in payments since 2000, in the dealing room before that for 10 years, and initially in retail banking from the late 70s.
Greg.
Hi everyone, I'm Greg James. I'm a senior manager in FSCOM and currently taking the lead on the advisory service side of things. Been here in the industry for about 10 years now, and with FSCOM for about 6.5 of those, so hoping to impart some of that knowledge to yourselves this evening.
Thank you, Greg. And last but not least, Anna.
Thank you. I'm Anna Sweeney. I'm a senior manager at FSCOM also. I am specialised in financial crime with a particular interest in AML. I've been in financial crime industry for around 12 years and just 3 months with FSCOM. So I'm the latest recruit that Alison was referring to.
Thank you, Anna. Now, this is the big reveal. Elaine is bringing up the results here, of which are the theme that the panelists believe, or sorry, the whole audience believe, are the most important for the year ahead. So safeguarding and operational resilience at 60%. Financial resilience at its interesting 40%.
Are we surprised to see safeguarding and operational resilience at the top if this is indeed an accurate representation?
I don't think I'm massively surprised by that. I think obviously safeguarding got a lot of attention in 2023 with the central bank's request for audits there. And then operational resilience with DORA coming. Well, sorry, DORA is now through the door. So I'm not overtly surprised by those two focuses anyway.
Yeah, I think similarly. So from what we would have seen, you know, the areas of which has drawn the most focus in the relatively recent past on the basis of the Dear CEO in relation to safeguarding and then DORA, you know, that upper resilience is key and paramount. So it is unsurprising. And I guess it provides, I guess, opportunity and challenge in equal measure in relation to sort of dealing with that on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I suppose in one way, not surprising, but I suppose to remember safeguarding doesn't apply to all sectors. So, and I presume we're talking not just payments here, so might just be worth considering that. But echo what's been said, absolutely.
Okay, well, folks, what we're going to do this afternoon is, or this evening, we're going to have a structured discussion around three key themes, which I'll tell you in a second. So I'm going to pose some questions, we're going to discuss amongst ourselves, and then, as I've said, please use Slido to add any questions, and then there'll be a question and answer session where we'll be responding to the questions that you're posing to us. So, as I said, three key things. We've got changing operational landscape, current areas of focus, and then new obligations on the horizon. And so first, looking at the current operational landscape, there's an element of a state of flux. I think it's fair to say the economic environment has presented tough challenges with investor funding, and the increasing cost of living has an impact on our payment and e-money institutions. And of course, in recent weeks, we've had the really very sad news of the decline of PFS and the ultimate winding down, which proves an interesting example of winding down being done well in terms of the impact on customers being very well managed, so it seems. Fergal, can I ask you, your business has only just been authorised. Is this a bad time to be getting into regulated activities?
Yes, it is. Nowhere else to do it. Yeah, I know. I don't know if there's ever a good time or a bad time. It's just a time. I suppose from our point of view, like we, myself and my co-founder Aaron mentioned, we effectively knew very little to nothing about payments and banking, etc. Maybe 3 years ago, effectively nothing really. About the regulatory landscape, etc. So we kind of set out to teach ourselves about it. And I suppose what we've seen is that there's been a shift in, the rigor of becoming an authorized institution. I think that there's the sort of level of professionalism and intensity of investigation of prospective regulated firms has become really, really high. So I think that's a really, really good thing. And I think it can just augur as well for the future because it means that, you know, a company becoming regulated now has gone through an incredibly rigorous process and it sets them up well for the future. So that's the first thing. So I think it's a good time in that respect. And in terms of technology, it's an absolutely amazing time because what's possible now is incredible. So our previous business was an IP telephony business, and we started in 2004, and it was a deregulation of telecoms, and we find the parallels in payments and banking incredible. Like, it's really, really interesting how similar they are. So if you think, payments and banking, core banking systems are simple compared to telephony billing systems. They're child's play, like they're really, really easy things. So, but what you can do now with technology is amazing. And the problem is that you've got these very, very large institutions, which some of them are working with programming languages from 50 years ago, and they're trying to deal with cloud computing and the instant economy And the opportunities are just immense, and the demand for services, the type of services we provide, are enormous as well. So I think it's a great time from that point of view. And that's sort of borne out, I suppose, by the investor interest, by the commercial interest as well in what we do. So based on that, I'd say it's a good time.
A positive outlook. Thank you. Jared, can I come to you, please?
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the similarities between the telecoms business and banking. I remember, I don't know, Russell, if you remember maybe about 20 years ago, you know, one of the threats in the landscape from a traditional bank's perspective was the emerging tech that was the forefront of which was the telecoms industry. And there was real, not concern necessarily, but there was identification that there was key skills evident within that sector that had application to others, and particularly the payments infrastructure, which is coming through with the advent of those new, I guess, the connectivity pieces, the computing pieces, you know, blockchain, to which you referred earlier on. So, you know, it's the ground is really really good for that. I think the challenge then, from where I sit, you know, as the traditional banker, is that, you know, what are the services that we can continue to provide, because we still feel, you know, from an overall infrastructural perspective, that we have relevance and, you know, provide a degree of compelling service to the sector. And I guess in looking at the sector that we cover, you know, we've identified that, you know, it is lucrative, it is a good sector to be in. However, you know, the barriers to entry are not insignificant, both in terms of key personnel, experience, knowledge, and indeed cost. And then the second part of that, obviously, is the regulatory oversight. You know, one of the things that we look for, you know, in sort of prospect and existing clients is the extent to which you're almost building from a compliance-led perspective, so that, you know, the ground is laid in cement in relation to adherence to the various regulations, because you can't get it wrong. You know, getting it wrong is not great for longevity. But, you know, it's a good sector to be in. It's fast moving, it's agile, it reacts very, very well to new and emerging tech, but it must be wrapped in a layer of compliance that is probably not seen in other sectors or in other industries. And that seems to be the one area where it drives, maybe not perfection, but drives really, really good activity, which is evident across the successful players within.
So there's very definitely scope for the successful players, hearing plenty of positive here. I think it would be interesting to talk about the demise of PFS, not in the specifics, but I think it's interesting to see how that plays out in terms of the winding down process. One of the newer requirements from the central bank in the authorization stage, at least, and certainly captured in the Dear CEO letter. Greg, would you want to talk us through some reflections on what we see when we talk to firms about wind down planning?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to be said about you pass it to compliance when we need to bring it down to we need to bring it down to a wind down plan. When we're talking about the positives of onward and upward in fintech, but I mean, there is this aspect here where there's a wind down plan is always quite a tough task to bring a firm along on the journey with, because it's obviously fairly it could be fairly sedating as a process. It is a process to run through what would happen and what are the main alerts and the triggers that you would experience to identify you required to wind down the business, which obviously isn't necessarily the first thing people want to talk about. But nevertheless, I think with kind of current circumstances, we sort of see the importance of that. PFS, for instance, you know, winding down with a plan, which is absolutely on a dissolvent basis, which is absolutely where we want to be as an industry going forward. But I mean, typically whenever we sort of look at wind down plans with firms, it kind of comes in sort of two different lenses, one of which is the wind down itself. So when things do eventually, if things do eventually go wrong, what are the processes, what are the alerts, et cetera, that you're looking for that actually occurs in to ensure that you go down in a solvent manner. But there's also the other aspect of that, which is how will you recover? Okay, so what will happen is if you start to engage with some of these alerts that can occur as part of the plan. So for instance, if your cash flow is not covering your overall operating runway, That would be a trigger for a lot of firms. And your triggers in your firms will be different, but that will be an alert and a trigger within your plan. And it's that is really, really good information to kind of keep track of, because not just is that sort of this alert of this could be going down a certain direction, we need to think about winding down, which is absolutely what it should be doing, but also how are we going to recover this position? What is going wrong? What are the underlying kind of root causes here, and how do we solve for that? So it, you know, we should start to look at wind down plans a lot more in the sense of sort of the DNB in the Netherlands have historically, which is sort of wind down a recovery plan. How do you recover from this position rather than just what do you do when it all goes wrong, which of course needs to be filtered into that process. So some of the things that you sometimes find with wind down plans is they never quite go to plan. No, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men. What ends up happening is, you know, you do all your best sort of planning, and actually behavioural elements come into this. So the suppliers might end up pulling out of the contract. Your the key members of staff that you've had planned, unsurprisingly, may not want to stick around for this process and may look to exit. So how have you accounted for those in your plan? Are you know, some of the areas that should really be considered in that plan. Those almost unquantifiables that you need to think about. Well, what happens if a key supplier pulls out? What are we doing about that? And you know, if we sort of pull it back to today's market, it sort of brings up this a historic point in the safeguarding regulations. Well, in the PSRs, but safeguarding specifically within the PSRs, and that is, how do the administrators get paid? If you wind down in an insolvent manner, how do they get paid? And other implementations of PSD2, the administrators would be paid by the safeguarder funds. That doesn't seem to be the place that the payment services regulations in Ireland would take us. The administrators are only paid after the funds are redistributed. So the question then becomes, where does that come? And that is very much an open question at this time.
Thank you. And wind down planning is one of the key parts of the authorisation process. Russell, it'd be great to talk more about the impact of the environment in the authorisations process, and noting Ger was saying about the high costs to entry.
I suppose we have to focus on the wind down plans because the regulators are sort of making them focus, but I think the attention is probably a bit overdone on them from the regulatory point of view. Payment service users are effectively protected by the safeguarding element of the regulations, in that no wind down plan is of any use if the money hasn't been safeguarded in the first place. And as regards trigger points, there are the minimum own funds requirement, which both those things were put in so there wouldn't be any potential concerns about fintechs getting into payments and all the rest. And I don't mean that as a negative. That's should be an assurance for the users of payment services. That's an extra safety net. That said, of course, it's very welcome to have an orderly wind-down plan in place ready to roll out when something goes wrong. As regards the appetite, I suppose, for getting authorised in Ireland, to these two gentlemen's points, like, it's less than 20 years since we had the first payment service directive. And actually, it was thanks to those telecoms you're talking about that we had a separate and parallel e-money directive, which maybe will all come together in PSD3, which we may talk about later, hopefully. Because anyway, but the technology has been mentioned, and PSD, the first PSD was brought in. We called it PSD1, but it wasn't called PSD1 then. It was just the Payment Service Directive, and I was in Bank of Ireland at the time, and we only looked at one of the implications for us, which was giving more information to customers, getting value in better time and stuff like that. But there's a whole section about the introduction of payment institutions and what do we care about them. But really up to that point, the banks had a complete monopoly on payments or virtually across the whole world. And we've got 50-odd authorised PIs and EMIs here in Ireland now, huge numbers in the UK, numbers across Europe. And they're all providing payments as well as all the banks. And okay, they're not quite as many banks as there were maybe before 2007, 2008. But there is room in the industry being delivered by technology and changes in consumer behaviour to allow more and more firms get into this space. And Ireland is still doing very well. I looked up some statistics. the central bank's own half-yearly service standard report suggests in the last 4 years of records, which is up to the half one of last year, they've acknowledged over 100 applications, mined to two letters, about 12, and about 8 authorizations within that. And that doesn't count the authorizations that were in the second half of last year. So it's still happening, and this is in Ireland, and this is with a regulator that has become more and more rigorous, as has been referenced here in its approach, perhaps rightly so. And most things it wants firms to do are good for those firms. But there are lots and lots of firms seeing Ireland as their European base, and there are use cases there for more acquirers, more e-money account providers, firms that are sitting in parallel with crypto asset providers and so on. So it's actually quite wonderful to think that Ireland is doing so well out of this, despite maybe having a reputation for having an overzealous regulator. But I think it's based on the evidence that we see, it's alive and well, and it's continuing to grow. And these companies, bar perhaps one sad case that might have been referenced, are all making profit, meeting their own funds requirements and so on. And there's still lots of applicants looking to do the same. So I think it's, like the lad said, yeah, a good time. It's
thriving. What was the number? 100, didn't you say?
Approximately, I didn't. It's about 102, I think. The 4 half-years up to the middle of last year, the central bank's own service standard reports say they acknowledged, or it might have been, went into the authorization phase, approximately 100 PI, EMI or AISP applications.
It's certainly indicative of a great deal of appetite.
Yeah, it also suggests, based on the number of authorizations, they have a hell of a backlog as well. But we'll get on to the quality of that later.
Or maybe it recycles a few who happen to come around again.
Well, there could be some double counts in there. Yeah. No, but it is, I mean, we know we're in the industry. A lot of people here are aware of what's going on. There's lots and lots of activity in Ireland in this space.
There is. It's certainly... we get a lot of calls from potential applicants, and one of the, you know, you won't be surprised to say that one of the key things that we say is, you know, please be aware there's plenty. You know, this is not the place for the faint-hearted. You know, the upfront costs that you will put into this business before you even get authorized is heavy, significant. You will go on a journey. It will be a journey where you will struggle. You will struggle with your stakeholders. You will struggle with the central bank. It is a long journey, but it's great. There's been a number of authorizations in the just at the back end of last year, which it's good to see the progress coming through. I'm sure everybody also feels like that too. And I wonder even if just the consultation, Russell, on the sandbox is an indication of perhaps a opening up to innovation again. I mean, obviously the hub's been there for a while.
Yeah, you're talking about the proposed sandbox central bank. Yeah, okay, well, the central bank opened an innovation hub in 2018, was it? And it was essentially only a couple of people, a phone number and an email address. But it opened huge doors because I was on the payments authorization team, as I said, and if a firm came to you and asked for advice, or, you know, whether they should apply for authorization or the services fall for regulation, we were legally not able to talk to them. But if they came to the Innovation Hub as a startup firm thinking of getting into payments, and, you know, what could they find out? The central bank would bring somebody like me from the payments authorization team here, Russell, tell these guys how it works. And and even in my time there, I'm gone about 2.5 years, there was at least 2 firms that come through from that Innovation Hub to the right through to application. And I think at least one was authorized. So it was a good message to the industry from the central bank. It was a good facility particularly for very small businesses, although big businesses came in as well. But for those small businesses that may not be able to afford legal fees or advice or whatever, to get a steer on where they should go. And quite often it's a tech product, but that might have payments associated with it. So they might need to have a payments authorization or an e-money authorization with it. Or as we're hoping now with sort of open banking solutions, maybe an AISP or PISP, that's account information services and payment initiation services. The idea of a sandbox, though, when I was there, was discussed a few times because the FCA had talked about one and introduced one. And there's my understanding of it is there's a bit of a legal issue because what does a sandbox mean if it's a regulatory sandbox? If a firm is providing what are regulated payment services and they're not authorized, haven't been regulated, haven't been authorized or registered, then they're breaking the law according to our regulation. So we'd have to pass a law to allow that, or else do something that it wasn't a regulated service being a regulated payment service being provided. So I think it's out for consultation at the moment. I don't know what it's going to evolve into. But even if it's a non-regulatory sandbox, but with firms that may be in the regulatory space somehow involved or sponsored by a tech firm or something, I think certainly something to be encouraged. And it's very, very good to see the central bank, I mean, to be the central bank engaging with the industry. We probably feel it doesn't do it enough. I certainly feel that it should be open and more transparent about a lot of things. It is quite open and transparent, actually, in the payment authorization process, albeit robust, as I said. But anything that helps the central bank make it clear to the industry how it feels about things, how it's going to assess applicants or supervise regulated firms, the more the better.
Do you get a sense, Russell, that they could, their terms of reference might change then if they deliver a sandbox that they might be like the UK regulator, that if they have an eye on competition or developing competition, they're exclusively regulatory oversight and control now. Is, you know, could that change the approach or the stance?
Yes, it could. I'd be surprised if it changes quickly with the central bank having been there, and the whatever the press release or whatever they issued in relation to the sandbox was so vague, anything could go in there. I think it would take a long time to change the regulatory regime to allow, you know, payment services provided to a test market or something. But I'm sure that some arrangement could be made to do something. And yeah, let's see. I think it's a good signal, though. Whatever it works out, whatever ends up happening, it's a good signal to the market rather than just saying, oh, no, we don't do sandboxes. And they've recruited a couple of people from private sector recently into that area. It's not just, dare I say, lifers in the central bank. I don't mean that with any disrespect, but it's obviously good to have diversity in there and a different approach to the industry. So, yeah, hope so.
And we'll take the opportunity then to move on to the second theme, which is areas of current focus. So we've got a message to the central bank there on transparency and potentially sort of being open to the competition piece, albeit I appreciate that's not for central bank to determine itself particularly. But let's look at the priorities of the central bank, what we expect them to be for the payment sector this year. And I think we're going to have to go with safeguarding first. So, Greg, safeguarding.
So obviously there was a massive focus on safeguarding last year with the expectation of the audit firms presenting their findings to the CBI. I don't necessarily want to relitigate that process because I imagine everybody's slightly scarred by it. But I think the key thing that we should be expecting this year out of that is the central bank have just received a huge amount of information on a lot of different operational models and how they solve that safeguarding equation. And the logical output of that from the Central Bank of Ireland is to come away with a lot of questions. One of those questions is going to be all these different operating models applying what is a very, very narrow piece of regulation naturally is going to create these areas of kind of grey, misunderstood, whether misunderstood or whether just not particularly well defined areas that each of these firms are kind of entertaining. And we are sort of expecting the CBI to sort of come back here and ask questions and to poke at some of these detailed questions. You know, for instance, if you are a card issuer and somebody has spent money on their card, when are those relevant funds no longer relevant throughout that chain? Is it when it pays out to the merchant acquirer? Is it when the person has utilized their card and therefore the authorization has come in? Or is it when, you know, Visa or MasterCard are actually calling for those funds? The regulation is not clear, and I imagine card issuers will have taken a fairly different viewpoint of that. And this is just going to be one of those areas that I think will sort of highlight in the central bank's mind the potential need for further exploration of these issues. We will touch on kind of PSD3 at some point, I'm sure, but PSD3 is floating this idea of regulatory technical standards for safeguarding. And honestly, it's a absolutely, you know, it's a requirement at this stage. When you really dig down into these, we got one for strong customer authentication. I don't see this as being any less complex than that.
That took a little while to.
That took more than a little while to get to. Yeah. I mean, there are more questions that sort of fall out of this, and that is this going to be an annual requirement? Because that is a relatively large overhead to be putting on to what is supposed to be a proportional proportional kind of market. That being said, I think general direction of travel from the central bank in this area, we could probably expect this to filter into, if not annually, more regular external checks of safeguarding arrangements, whether that is kind of continued on the sort of by an accountancy service, or whether they expand that potentially. But regardless, I think that is something that we're hoping to hear more news on. But I think the general swing of things is that may end up being a more frequent requirement. It wasn't a one and done, so to speak.
Thanks, Greg. Chair, representing a safeguarding partner to many, what's your impression of the usefulness of the audit and the uptake of that in the sector?
Look, it's of paramount importance, certainly from our perspective as providing the safeguarding accounts. And I guess, you know, it points to a key piece of the puzzle being put together and carried out and delivered upon in an Uber compliant manner. And I guess, you know, we've all been through audits and of various ilks, and you know, it's rare and unusual, I think, if you come through clean and unscathed with no findings from an audit. And I think, you know, from the traditional banker providing the client safeguarded accounts and monies and the attestations there too, I think one of the key pieces for us is, first of all, the artifact itself and the information therein. But I think following that, any of the findings that are noted, it's the, I suppose, the management response and action plan around that. You know, is there a clear identification of, you know, where whatever major, minor or whatever issue has been found? You know, can that be addressed? Can it be done so in a timely manner? And it can be done so in full transparency. I guess, you know, we as bankers, we do like to see an independent audit of some ilk on an annualized basis, as we do our enhanced due diligence, given that we view the sector, particularly the sector, you know, where you have a payments license and you carry out payments, you know, we view that sectorally as being higher risk. And as a consequence, we will do diligence on an annualized basis. One of the key artifacts within that process is an independent audit, be that of safekeeping or safeguarding rather, or indeed, you know, the governance control and oversight that is evident in the policies, procedures, personnel and systems that are used to do so. So it's something that, you know, we don't see going away. It's something on which we place, you know, quite a degree of reliance in addition to the analysis and diligence that we would carry out ourselves to continue to provide support and service to payment institutions, be it through safeguarding with ourselves or using our payment rails. So, you know, it's important artifact. The response from management is key to the full suite of correspondence around that. And we do see it being, you know, a potentially one that will continue in some guise, be it as part of an overall independent audit or specific to safeguarding as time goes on.
Thanks, Jerry. Virgil, can I ask you?
I don't know where to start in safeguarding. For us, the number of banks that could provide a safeguarding account that have the technical ability to provide one is probably zero, I'd say. I struggle to think of somebody that we would want to work with and has the ability to provide a safeguarding account with us.
Untaken.
Their challenge goes back the way.
So that, like, you know, you're talking about, and I totally agree with it, like, you've got a customer ledger and you've got funds in your customer ledger and you've got a safeguarding account, the two have to match. This is trivial stuff. Like, how can you be getting this wrong? You know, like, this is really, really simple stuff. And yet, it's just constantly happening. Like, it's farcical. So, you know, we have gone through the process and have to go out and get a safeguarding provider. There's probably realistically five in Europe that you can go to, maybe, And of those, maybe one is just about capable of providing it to an adequate standard. Maybe. And even then, it's just adequate. It's like, it'll do, you know? So that's how bad it is. So it's, you know, it's great that there's all the focus on safeguarding and audit and all the rest of it, but I mean, it's hardly surprising there's problems because it is, it's ridiculous. It's farcical, you know?
And one of the things PSD3 is looking to focus on and PSD2 tried is the requirements on banks to offer safeguarding accounts and to spread it out. And obviously in recent years, the insurance, Protein Risk is one of the providers of insurance.
But it's not just a safeguarding account, you know, it's actually access to the payments rails, you know. So if you're not a credit institution, you can't participate in SEPA directly. And even of the 5,500 banks or so in Europe, only about 200 of them are direct participants of SEPA, you know. And of those, you could probably count in one hand the number of ones you'd actually want to work with, you know. So they're the real problems. Like they're what causes all the issues with safeguarding and requirements for audit and et cetera. Apart from the, you know, the card issue, you know, where you've got settlement of card payments and their net of commission and you don't know what, you know, because that's another system that was invented 60 years ago with numbers on the front of the card and hacked to work on the internet. Like, so it's not surprising either, but that's where we are, you know. So that's why you kind of need all the audits and the external controls, et cetera, for safeguarding, because the underlying systems are so appalling.
I'll pause on safeguarding there. We could probably spend a lot of time on safeguarding and the technology that goes along with that. Anna, I'm sorry.
One thing, if you don't mind, Anna, a suggestion, and I completely agree with when I was in the central bank, and since there's a lack of appetite amongst banks generally to provide these, why don't the central banks themselves offer that service? And indeed, both safeguarding and indeed access to the payment systems. The Bank of Lithuania does it. For some Irish customers, I can tell you as well. And it's just food for thought. It's one of the only ones, absolutely. I'm not saying the central bank is an exception in this, but I, you know, if it's so important, and it's rightly important for the regulators that money be safeguarded properly.
That regulation is coming, though, isn't it? It's been discussed in relation to direct access to schemes for EMI licensed entities. So, you know, that has probably a journey to go to get to execution, but I think it's been recognised as...
That's why Lithuania has become the fintech capital of Europe. That's one of the fundamental reasons, you know, is because that is the service that's provided there with Centrelink and the Bank of Lithuania. They've done an amazing job.
That is the indirect access to SEPA, where you develop your IBANs and all that.
Like, we've gone to safeguarding banks and said, so we're going to do direct debit. Oh, we don't do that. You're a bank. Like, how can you not do direct debit? You know?
Very challenged. Very challenged. We'll pause there. we do want to go to the AML risks that we see. Touched on in the DRC, not more than touched on in the DRCO letter last year. Anna, what do we see coming along?
I suppose so. One of the relevant deficiencies that was called out was all about agent relationships. And particularly how firms interact with their agents, how they manage those relationships, and thinking, you know, particularly from an AML perspective, it's quite common and absolutely fine for firms that are working with agents for agents to perform some of the AML functions. But what we really need to see is greater oversight of those functions and greater accountability and ownership of that. So you know, firms. We want to see them understanding that relationship more as like an extension of themselves. You know, they're ultimately liable for the controls that their agents are undertaking on their behalf. So they have to be really comfortable that they know exactly what their agents are doing and that's aligned with their risk appetite and their priorities. And there are, this is an area that we're seeing our clients struggle with all the time. Right, these are really regular findings that are coming out of our audits, but there are some really practical ways that that firms can manage those risks and can demonstrate
that they're comfortable with the controls that are in place, and also are able to intervene if they become uncomfortable with how some of those controls are conducted. So we see things like onboarding, really stringent onboarding of agents, making sure from the outset that firms understand well the agent's policies, walkthroughs of those policies and procedures in practice. More regular and more intrusive periodic reviews, for example. It's really useful for firms also to obtain regular MI from their agents, which would allow them to intervene as soon as sort of a problem was detected. And then, of course, an external audit is invaluable as well to give that kind of independent third-party view of where deficiencies may lie. But yeah, just above all, just firms need to remember that they're ultimately liable should anything go wrong. So they need to have a really good understanding of what their agents are doing for them.
And when we talk about agents, we could switch that out, everything you said. It'd still be, you know, even where it's intergroup outsourcing. And
right,
obviously
right.
Outsourcing continues to be a major focus for the central bank. Even in the safeguarding piece as well has really been picked up. Greg, is there anything on outsourcing that you want to mention?
I mean, we could be here all night. Thanks for that. I mentioned outsourcing, but it's that sort of reliance point with fraud and AML more generally. There is always kind of an undertone of whenever you're discussing with firms about outsourcing that intragroup is different to third-party outsourcing, right? So if I outsource to my sister entity in Malta, then everything is okay. Sure, the legislation says not, but we all know, it's fine. It genuinely isn't. I think the point here is that, and you sort of see this tone with the IAF, the Individual Accountability Framework, but it's that delegation of duty, right? Somebody still owns this within your firm. There is still a delegated then responsibility down. Now, that responsibility hasn't left. All that happened is that you move the operational running of that to someone else. And how do you oversee that? What are you actually doing about that? And we know the central bank are focused on this. They continue to be focused on this, and they will be forevermore focused on this because it is how businesses function, right? Everybody's got to take advantage of economies of scale. They are not going to run everything absolutely locally through the one legal entity, but therefore the outsourcing controls sort of apply. And how you manage for that is not a million miles away from how you would manage that if you were doing it in-house, and shouldn't necessarily be treated overtly differently, aside from obviously different legal entity. You're going to need contracts in place. It's not implicit through the business offerings.
Thank you. Individual accountability and succession planning, a thing for this year?
Yes. So, individual accountability officially went live there at the tail end of last year. So everybody no doubt has everything ready and completely up to scratch with it. Individual accountability, I always think, is quite an interesting one because nothing in there strikes me as particularly controversial, but nevertheless, it is one of those areas that you need your defensible documents, right? So how do I actually prove this out? How do I prove that my CEO is fit and proper for their position? Well, we sort of know they are, right? We all kind of implicitly understand that the senior executives all sort of know what they're doing. So the question then is, how do we prove it? How do we track through, and how do we monitor that in a meaningful sense? It's sort of the exam question that individual accountability framework kind of poses to us all. And from that delegated point, those people will not do every single task sort of assigned to them. They will be delegating that out, right? And who is that delegated to? Are they fit and proper to conduct that delegation, and how are you overseeing that? What comfort are you getting from that, from them taking on that role? I suppose the only thing when it comes to individual accountability framework that you do get. I appreciate as well the concern some people have with it, with the severing of the participation link, effectively saying that you don't necessarily need to be, the central bank don't need to prove that you were directly involved in this. They just sort of need to point back to this concept that you were in charge of the firm. And that I understand that can cause a little bit of concern for anybody taking on a PCF role. But now that, you know, it is where we are now, and sort of, you know, have your ducks in a row, and sort of balance that out.
Thank you. We'll switch now our focus to the horizon scanning and look at I think we've all got our fingers crossed for Alma, Anna.
Oh, yes. Fingers very much crossed. I suppose we're already seeing the challenge that I see, right? So we're already seeing challenges in the sector with firms struggling to source the right people in the right roles, especially those kind of senior management roles. It's kind of become a little bit of like an inside joke. How do you retain an MLRO, right? And whilst the...
Lots of money.
Well, that is one, yeah. But it is more than that, right? but I guess what's already kind of a challenging time could become further challenged if Ireland were to be successful in the short term anyway, in being the host nation for the EU AML authority. I think thinking more positively in like the medium to longer term, the benefits obviously far outweigh the kind of resourcing challenges that it might initially bring, in terms of like the talent and so on that it will that'll attract to the island. But yes, I think certainly in kind of the near future, we're gonna see compounded challenges in trying to attract and retain people at those senior management levels.
Thank you. Russell, PSD3, reauthorizations, is that gonna be a worry?
Yeah, it will be a worry. When PSD2 came in almost exactly 6 years ago, and it was the 13th of January 2018, if I remember rightly, we had about 13 or 14 PIs and EMIs in Ireland at the time, and they had to apply for reauthorization, which had to be done within 6 months, which was 13th of July that year. I believe they're talking about 24 months, which obviously would make things a lot easier. But as I said earlier, we've got 50 firms now, so we've got four times the number of firms and four times the sort of time period to do it. So maybe we'll be just as frantic. The way it worked at the central bank last time round, it was the payment supervision team that did the assessment of the extra bit that the currently authorised firms had to contribute to get up to the PSD2 standards. And they all came through pretty much at the same time at the end. But 24 months sounds like much more realistic. The payment supervision team is a lot bigger now as the market has grown in that time. And going by what firms are experiencing going through the application process at the moment, I think it'd be far better news, I suppose, if the supervision team did it again this time. But PSD3, there will be further there'll be clarification on some things. We'll go through it all now, but in terms of the reauthorization, hopefully it'll be a relatively smooth journey. There's plenty of time ahead of it being announced, and hopefully the central bank will have the resources to communicate what the process is and put mechanisms in place for submissions to be made and so on, and the transparency that we've been talking about that we'd like to see to make it clear what standards or whatever they expect to be in that.
I'm looking to Fergal for his nod of you're happy that being a recent authorisee, it'll be a smooth process for you the next time.
Well, I hope so. No, yeah, we don't know the details, I suppose. Yeah, but I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. Nothing to add beyond that.
Greg, PSD3 highlights for you.
So probably not worth going through the entire text here, but I think that there's a few sort of key ones that we want to pull out. The reauthorization process, obviously, the sort of 18 to 24 months process is, it's good, you know, I would hazard a guess, but a future saying here, that's not going to be the most smooth process we've all ever experienced in our lives, but nevertheless, something that we'll sort of be going through. I think sort of importantly for me is this sort of expansion in AIS, account information services and payment initiation services. That expansion of that definition will be great for the industry, but also this sort of element here that seems to suggest that any sort of technology service provider may end up being in the scope of this regulation as well, which on the surface at least seems like a very broad application of the rules, and could be a bit of a struggle for some firms that have sort of quite firmly de-scoped themselves out of this by utilizing a technology service provider to offer the services for them. I think to the side of that as well, capital requirements, right? So it's always going to be a focus for regulators, and there seems to be a general direction shift that method B, so the method that is predicated on your payment volumes, is going to be the primary or the default capital requirement or capital calculation, ongoing capital calculation. Having done a fair number of capital calculations in my day, I'll tell you that method B is almost universally the largest of the three methods. A, typically the smallest, is 10% of your overheads. Fintechs are really good at keeping their overheads quite, you know, close to the ground. And then C, method C, is effectively based on the income, and the margins on payments, we all know, are pretty tight. So almost invariably, your payment volumes are going to be the most significant. And I think that is, we have to sort of recognize that as being a slight change of direction when we were sort of talking almost universally as proportionality, proportionality, proportionality. That is a proportionality, but with a step of enhancement of expectations. I think we sort of need to accept and sort of understand that. And then, you know, I'm going to, of course, talk about safeguarding again, because why wouldn't I? But there are a few changes to safeguarding. And to sort of pick up an earlier point, there will be, or it certainly seems the direction that there is going to be more expectation for you to spread your concentration risk. So in other words, you must have more counterparties in order to safeguard with. Now, to the sort of previously discussed point, there aren't a lot of players in the market. Firms already have a very hard time getting safeguarding providers, getting banking providers generally. The expectation placed on firms to get further sort of partners in that area is going to be a massive roadblock for people getting authorized. It gets a little bit easier if you kind of show a current trading book and things like that. But I think we all have to acknowledge that that is going to be a roadblock. I absolutely don't disagree that the concentration risk here should be mitigated, but I think the appreciation of just how difficult it is to get a safeguarded bank account in the market, I don't think is filtering into that decision as heavily as it potentially should be. So it'll be interesting to see if that is changed a little bit to be a little bit more proportionate. So if you have over X amount of assets, you need to move them across then, or something to that effect.
Thanks. And Anna, there's a fraud piece in there.
Yes, enhanced look at fraud. I think there's always an enhanced look at fraud. But we are seeing, we know there's going to be new measures introduced, right? Things around better data sharing between providers, IBAN confirmation. We've got stronger customer authentication. It's very consumer focused, right? It's putting more of the onus on firms to prevent fraud from occurring in the first place, which is, you know, fantastic as a customer and as a consumer. There's a specific item around extending the rights of victims of fraud. Less information around what that's actually going to look like. And it poses the question, are we going to go down the route that we're seeing in the UK, for example, where we've got mandatory reimbursement for victims of APP fraud, and where the cost of that reimbursement is split 50-50 between the sender and the receiving institution. And, well, I think we've all seen the challenge that that's been met with, particularly from kind of smaller players in the market, you know, because the thresholds for reimbursement are really quite significant. I think it's upwards of £400,000, I think. So, you know, it's pretty hefty chunks. But I think ultimately, yeah, it's all about putting more onus on firms to prevent fraud in the first place. And I think, I think greater data sharing is really what's going to be key to achieving that. But for now, I guess we'll just have to watch the space. We're not exactly sure what it's going to look like.
You're absolutely right. Our UK event last week, fraud was the key thing that was looked at, and sort of the chill going through the spine of all the payment and e-money institutions about the cost that's going to be. Fergal.
To say, one of the interesting things with, I think, PSD3 and with the advent of instant payments, you know, PIS is suboptimal probably at the moment, the PIS experience. But I think when it becomes potentially a premium service and something that, you know, participants can potentially earn from, then it opens up lots of new possibilities, particularly in the area of wallets, you know, where a wallet can be funded from your current account and debited almost instantly. And of course that's enormously powerful, you know, and I think it's going to spawn an awful lot of change over the next sort of 3 or 4 or 5 years. But with that is the area of fighting fraud and combating fraud. And one of the areas I think that we really need to look at is how we actually approach combating fraud, you know, because the tools that were in operation for the last 20 years are not going to be the right tools for the next 20 years, you know. So it's very much a kind of a manual process now, you know. And I suspect if you've seen the power of ChatGPT or something like that, so if you're using if you've got a significant amount of data, which, you know, a payments institution would have, and you can point out at the instances of fraud, I suspect that a machine learning approach to identifying fraud and combating it would be far superior to the sort of approach that we take at the moment, you know. So I think that the regulations and legislation, etc., has to start enabling that approach to combating it rather than throwing people at it, which is almost the approach we have now.
Certainly an opportunity area for a technology solution, isn't it? I am going, panel, you've been amazing. The grilling is not over yet. Let's switch to the Slido and hear your questions, please.
Fergal, other than the comments about why is Fergal so negative on banks, we're going to go back to safeguarding. So to ensure consistency across safeguarding process, can the central bank be more prescriptive so there is less guesswork? More of a statement, maybe, than a question?
I mean, could they? Absolutely. But I think it's important to sort of consider where the central bank's sort of resources are at the moment and whether they are going to put in a huge amount of time to produce something similar to what the FCA have in their approach document and sort of get that checked off and run through policy and back and forth and back and forth through a consultation period. Or will they just sort of grit their teeth and wait for the regulatory technical standards out of PSD3? Now, it's a bit of a long wait on that, so I probably wouldn't be my recommendation. But you know, it's an interesting point, right? Will they come out on the back of the audit 2023? Will they come out with more bespoke, a more prescriptive guidance, or will they just hold off for the regulatory?
And I always find another question here because you have to be really careful what you ask for, because at this stage, you have the opportunity to put your best case forward and argue why the position you've taken is the right one, you know, and as long as you've got something reasonable and you've thought through your risks and your board has carefully accepted the risks, you have a position. Once you start getting it nailed down in central bank guidance, you know, that's your opportunities for doing it the way you think most suitable for your business has gone.
Well, actually, can I just jump in on that? Different for the UK now, with the FCA not being part of the EU anymore, I suppose. But PSD2 is a maximum harmonisation legislation, and all of the central banks, or most of the regulators, signed up to the EBA guidelines and authorisation, which prohibits individual regulators from adding to the requirements. as well as taking away from them. So the short answer to the question is perhaps theoretically they could, central bank, but almost certainly they won't. And that's one of the reasons, as well as resources and intransigence and all that kind of stuff. But it's very unlikely that the central bank would bring out something specific that would be individual to Ireland and not to anywhere else.
Okay. Although there was guidance, wasn't there, at the before the second e-money directive came in, or maybe it was from the second e-money directive, and then it went away after the second payment service directive.
Yeah. Just my experience there. Okay, gone a while. It could be changing, but would be reluctant to do anything individual like that.
Yeah.
And they wait for PSD3 at this stage.
Yeah.
Okay. Back to PFS. What about the regulator handling of PFS, since the restriction of business growth must have contributed to the wind down? What are their learnings for other firms? Anybody want to take that one?
I don't know the case in detail, so I don't think anybody on the panel is going to want to comment on the detail, but I think the learning is that come under scrutiny, it's going to be a very uncomfortable journey, and
I just throw in what I mentioned earlier. The lawmakers back in, they're putting the e-money directive and second payment services directive together, well, the original one actually, by putting in safeguarding and own funds requirements, are putting two massive safety nets for payment service users. And at least we're here talking about a particular firm winding down, and hopefully in an orderly manner. One wouldn't like to think of the consequences. I'm not saying for this particular firm or any individual firm, if the money wasn't safeguarded or if they were allowed to decide themselves how much own funds needed to be kept and so on. So the regulations are intended to and are generally keeping firms on the straight and narrow in that regard. Lots of other aspects, but I think all of us payment service users and people in the industry should be aware or appreciate how important those two fundamental things really are, and why payments and e-money firms are different from banks and funds providers and everything else. That is the restriction, but it's also the benefit for the user.
I'd echo that. Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually a reasonably good endorsement of the system in that the funds were protected, etc. And if you think about it, if your funds are safeguarded, like an EMI or payment institution, they can't access the funds at all. This is in stark contrast to a bank, where if somebody defaults on all of the money that they've lent out, the funds aren't there, and you're restricted in your deposit guarantee of 100,000 euro. So it's a stark contrast to that, That's one thing. The other thing I was just going to say is that I don't really know the details of the case, but I know that the model where a business, an EMI or a payment institution, outsources the onboarding of customers is a big, big issue. It's something that we would never do, see that, because we've seen so many problems with it, where you onboard a company and you say to them, listen, you onboard the customers for us and we won't really have any visibility into them. I think that's a really big issue which has been addressed too. So yeah, my comment.
Okay, thank you. Another question here. The main areas of supervisory focus for the central bank. Do you think there's any areas subject to thematic inspection this year? I know we did talk quite a bit about safeguarding.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to be a fairly common theme that the central bank are never too far away from a thematic review. There are certainly we certainly heard of firms being requested their outsourcing registers, and potentially you were in this cohort. But I think that sort of speaks to the central bank's continuing focus on outsourcing, and also the fact that sort of very quick turnaround for that. So the expectation that this is there, this is live, and it is a source of truth for the firm. So that could be certainly sort of early warning signs of something coming down that way. And what one of the key areas that the central bank are always going to focus on, and we're in the DRCO letter from last year, was the regulatory reporting and making sure that that's accurate, especially with the introduction of the new data standard. So I think, you know, if there continue to be inaccurate data sets going into the central bank, then we could probably expect some focus on that as well.
Okay. With PSD3, are we likely to see the divergence between the UK and EU that will impact firms operating in both jurisdictions, potentially in areas like strong customer authentication?
I think that's a real possibility. It's something that a lot of firms are very alert to when they've got fits in both camps. And it is of interest and of concern, I'd say, probably more particularly to the FCA given the situation. Interestingly, at our payments event last week, we had the FCA flagging a whole rake of changes in the regulatory context. They're taking the opportunity to review the whole regime and bring it closer. I think it'll look much more like BISMA, so safeguarding is going to be more like CAS, which is the client assets regime under the Financial Services and Markets Act. I think even things like consumer duty creates greater requirements and a different focus in the UK for the UK firms that, you know, ends up probably backfilling and over to other firms where there's bits in both camps. I think there's a strong. The other thing was strong customer authentication. That
so,
you mentioned.
Yeah, I think strong customer authentication is kind of an interesting one as well, because if we look at PSD3 and Anna sort of made this comment earlier, it's stronger customer authentication, right? That ER they had. They're looking at enhancing the current status, whereas the sort of tonality from Treasury in the UK is we're going to start peeling back some of this. So I think that that's a really interesting change of tones comparing the UK and Europe, and I think that's going to be one of those areas where it starts to deviate pretty significantly. And this stuff is always kind of on the go, right? It wasn't too long ago that we really started to see GDPR and the Data Protection Act in the UK starting to kind of deviate from each other. And I think that's sort of clues for what's coming. And that is greater deviation rather than, than harmonization.
Could I just jump in on that as well? Just on the first bit of that, just to be technically clear, the same firms are not operating in both jurisdictions since Brexit. They have two separate entities. They may be part of a group, but the group are used to dealing with multi-jurisdictional situations. And as regards to strong customer authentication, and I know we're probably moving into an era where the traditional card-based payments will be challenged by push payments and so on, and without opening up all of that, most of the practical strong customer authentication that we do when we do our transactions are international standards for MasterCard, Visa and so on. And I suspect it wouldn't be in the UK's interests to deviate from those, even if the minimum standard were to somehow be lowered. I imagine they'd maintain them, for consistency across those things. Just a couple of points on it.
Thank you. I think there's probably, Elaine's giving me a nod that there's plenty more questions, but mindful of your time, so I am going to thank the panel very much. Brilliant contribution. I'm hoping that most, if not all, will be able to stay around for a little while because we have refreshments in the other room. And so I turn to you and thank you for being an excellent audience, and hope that you will be able to stay and enjoy the refreshments with us and pose your questions directly to the panel members as you prefer. Thank you.
Thank you very much.